are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months.
Always for them, duty, honor, country.
Has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba.
The war in Vietnam.
We will not turn, we will not falter, and we will not fail.
Welcome to the American Military History Podcast. I'm your host, Justin, and this is episode 39, The Battle of Saratoga, Part 1. This will be part 36 of our series on the Revolutionary War. William Howe's defeat of George Washington at the Battle of Brandywine was only a piece of a much greater plan. If you'll recall from our episodes leading up to that battle, you'll recall that Howe was simply just the southern part of an invasion that was supposed to come from the north, down from Canada. And that force was under the command of John Burgoyne. And the southward movement of that force had an ultimate goal of joining forces with Howe for a final push on the American capital. This episode will jump back in time just a few weeks, but it's important to understand the backstory. In the past few episodes, we've been focusing on Washington and his maneuvers against Howe. Now we'll focus on what was going on at the same time to the north. George Bernard Shaw, in his play The Devil's Disciple, describes Lieutenant General John Burgoyne as, quote, a man of fashion, gallant enough to have made a distinguished marriage by an elopement, witty enough to write successful comedies, aristocratically connected enough to have had opportunities of high military distinction. Burgoyne's campaign from Canada towards Lake Champlain had captured Fort Ticonderoga and was continuing its advance towards Albany. At the end of the letter Burgoyne had written describing his plan for the campaign, he stated that he, quote, must never lose the view of their intended junctions with Sir William Howe as their principal objects. Burgoyne's regular troops were hardened, disciplined men, and a formidable fighting force. Their officers were all professionals, and the generals were competent veterans. General Phillips, the second in command, was a fine artilleryman and a noted strategist. Baron von Riedesel, the major general commanding the left wing, was a 20-year veteran with a splendid record of campaigning under the Duke of Brunswick in the Seven Years' War. He was noted for his tact, good judgment, and coolness in the heat of battle. At 38, he was in his prime, strong and in good health. He was accompanied by his blue-eyed baroness and their three children. Burgoyne's irregular forces did not fare as well. Instead of the 2,000 Canadian militia that he expected, only 150 had joined up. Most of them were Frenchmen who had fought for Montcalm under the French flag. Of the 2,000 Indians expected to join the expedition, only about 400 showed up for duty as scouts and guides. In this episode, please note I do bounce back and forth between Indians and Native Americans. I mean the same thing. Last, only 100 Loyalists enlisted, but Burgoyne was counting on most of the Loyalist population in New York and other provinces rallying to his cause as his army moved through to liberate them. And this is something that's interesting to note. This is almost an illusion that a lot of the British commanders lived under. They felt that the local populace would rally to their cause simply because they were British and they were there to put down the Americans. What they failed to realize, however, is that even though the population of the colonies may have started British, some of the people there may have been even born British, now they were American, and they wouldn't always side with their former royalty. Burgoyne was also faced with the logistical problems of moving his force. There were insufficient horses to move the artillery, but the baggage train also lacked horses as well. Then, too, that same baggage train had to be made up of 500 light, two-horse carts that were hastily built out of green lumber. They were transports that would not stand up well under the rough usage of forest travel and warfare. As it moved south, Burgoyne's campaign would take Ticonderoga without a fight. We talked about this a few episodes ago. The American forces were in retreat from Ticonderoga with a makeshift flotilla on Lake Champlain. The British pursuit was well planned. Fraser and Riedesel were to chase after American commander St. Clair. Burgoyne sent General Phillips with a division loaded on boats to go south on the water after the fleeing American flotilla. Burgoyne was to follow Phillips with several frigates and the fastest of his gunboats. Once on land and in pursuit of the Continentals, Burgoyne was locked into a terrain that was a military nightmare. The roads, if you could call them that, were no more than crude trails, hacked out of the dense forest and running every which way, without plan or reason. The undergrowth was dense and broken only by countless fallen trees. In Christopher Ward's words from his work, The War of Revolution, quote, "It crossed no fewer than 40 deep ravines, over which high and long bridges had been built. There were also numerous swamps and bogs." What the British would consider to be a military nightmare, the retreating Americans would actually consider to be somewhat of a godsend, specifically General Philip Schuyler, who sought to delay the enemy as long as possible so that he could gather and make ready his forces. He had his men use every natural obstruction possible to slow the way of the British. He sent out 1,000 axemen to fell trees across the route and Wood Creek. They rolled boulders down the hills into the creek to make it impossible to pass with boats. Some woodsmen destroyed bridges, while others dug ditches that drained rainfall into a muddy, nasty mess. Schuyler also encouraged local farmers to drive away their cattle, hide their foodstuffs, and burn their grain fields so that the British would have to advance across a wasteland when they were not struggling through the forest. Schuyler was obstinate. Burgoyne was determined. He sent sappers, soldiers, and Canadian woodsmen by the hundreds ahead of the army to clear the trails, drain the swamps, and rebuild the bridges. In short, to undo all that Schuyler's men had done. They even managed to build a causeway 2 miles long to pass the artillery and wagons. By the 29th of July, he was finally at Fort Edward. In the past 21 days, he had managed to move only 23 miles. While Burgoyne's men were making their slow but steady process through the wilderness, Schuyler's delaying actions had bought him time and reinforcements that he so badly needed. By the 12th of July, he was joined by St. Clair with his main force, and Colonel Long had brought his detachment from Skenesborough. Schuyler's total strength at Fort Edward came to 4,500 men, 2,900 of those being Continentals, and 1,600 of those being militia. But Schuyler was not about to defend such a rundown fort as Fort Edward. The condition of the fort was so bad that he had told Washington that in order to enter it, he simply had to jump the ruined walls with his horse. He and his forces fell back down the Hudson to Saratoga, and on August 3rd, back to Stillwater, which was 12 miles to the south of Saratoga. Despite the wisdom and cunning he showed in delaying Burgoyne, on the 3rd of August he was relieved of command of the Northern Army, to be replaced by Major General Horatio Gates. The removal of Schuyler's command was purely political, and it was the culmination of months of factional fighting in Congress, during which Schuyler and St. Clair were accused of being traitors. If you'll recall from a few episodes ago where we talked about the siege of Ticonderoga, the locals in the area thought that Schuyler had given up Fort Ticonderoga to the British too easily, and they were convinced that he was a traitor and working with the British. Now, he was later exonerated and they found that he was not, but at the time, they relieved him of his command. And in fact, there was even a ridiculous, what they called a silver balls story. And what they said there was that when Burgoyne came to Fort Ticonderoga, he had his men load silver balls into their muskets and cannon, fire that into the fort, and then St. Clair and Schuyler would take that, and that would be their payment for their treason. Now, Schuyler received Gates when he arrived on August 19th to assume command by being a perfect gentleman. He put himself at Gates' disposal, and he gave him detailed briefings to familiarize the new commander with all aspects of the situation that he was inheriting. And by the time Gates had assumed his new command, Burgoyne's troubles, which had started with 3 weeks traversing adverse terrain, had been multiplying. His thrown-together supply wagon transport could not be depended on for the indefinite shuttling of supplies over miles of the rough wilderness roads, and the shortages were already being felt. A letter from Howe had stated that he would soon be going all out in his campaign against Philadelphia, and would certainly not be coming up the Hudson to join Burgoyne at this point in time. Burgoyne's orders were to proceed to Albany, and with or without reinforcements from Howe, he was determined to do so. Burgoyne's orders also stated that his mission was to, quote, to try the affections of the people, to disconcert the counsels of the enemy, to mount Riedesel's dragoons, to complete Peter's corps of loyalists, and to obtain large supplies of cattle, horses, and carriages. In addition, and I think that this is a very interesting note, written into his orders, it said, the commander could take hostages for the delivery of the above and further take prisoner, quote, all persons acting in committees or any officers acting under the directions of Congress, whether civil or military. So Burgoyne actually had permission to take hostage or imprison pretty much anyone he deemed to be non-loyal to the British crown. Now here, chronologically, we are at the events that I described in episode number 33, the Battle of Bennington. And if you haven't listened to that episode yet, feel free to go back and listen. I'm not really going to discuss it here because we've already discussed it. So after the Battle of Bennington, we see Burgoyne's forces severely impacted. He's had 207 killed or wounded, 700 captured, including dragoons, and his material losses were even worse. Hundreds of muskets and Jaeger rifles, 4 ammunition wagons, 250 swords, and 4 cannon. The loss of almost 1,000 men pales in comparison to the supplies that he did not capture, as he had been counting on them to feed and supply his army. His most immediate need now was to feed them. He dispatched an order that stopped his troops and encamped them at Fort Miller, which is about 4 miles above Saratoga, to allow for his supply wagons to be brought up. While encamped, his woes accumulated. His Native American allies were restless. There had been an incident involving a young woman named Miss Jane McCrae, who had been murdered and scalped by Native Americans in July. In response, Burgoyne had been forced to oversee and restrict the movements of his Native Americans to a much greater degree. Now, this didn't sit well with that group, as they were used to their operational independence. And then upon hearing about the events at Bennington, that group decided to head for home. In a few short days, Burgoyne's force of 400 Native Americans dropped to less than 40. The final blow to Burgoyne was on the 23rd of August, 1 week after the Battle of Bennington, when British commander St. Leger made his departure from Fort Stanwix along with some 350 regulars, 300 good loyalist soldiers, and hundreds of Native Americans, a force that would have replenished most of Burgoyne's recent losses. Now all of that was gone, along with any hope of bringing in neighboring counties and adjacent regions to the British cause. While Burgoyne was drowning in his sorrows, Horatio Gates was counting his reinforcements. By the first week of September, Benedict Arnold, our favorite traitor, had arrived, bringing with him 1,200 men. Also the same week, another group of reinforcements, which just happened to be dispatched by Washington right before the Battle of Brandywine, arrived. And while it was only 375 men, it was a solid addition. It was comprised of Colonel Daniel Morgan's corps of Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Maryland riflemen. Gates not only welcomed Morgan, no doubt having heard of his service in Quebec, and you can check back on my episodes covering the Battle of Quebec to learn more about that. I think it's in the 20s, episode 20-something. But Gates also added to Morgan's command Major Henry Dearborn, who was a veteran of Bunker Hill and Quebec, with 250 hand-picked light infantry that were armed with muskets and bayonets. What Gates had done here was effectively created an elite corps of light infantry with a solid commander. By September the 9th, Gates had reached an operating strength of 7,000 men, and he was focused on looking for better ground on which to oppose Burgoyne's advance. By September the 12th, he had moved his army to an area called Bemis Heights, where Arnold and the Polish engineer Kosciuszko had marked out the lines. And what that means is, they had marked out where the various units in Gates' army should deploy. If you think about it nowadays, it's almost like they took the field paint, like the orange paint that you see, you know, civil engineers or something using when they have to tell you where to dig for pipes or whatever else. That's basically what they did. And they did it on the ground and said, this is where our men are going to stand. Obviously, they didn't have, you know, spray paint, but you get the idea. The positions that the men had chosen were ideal for defense. There was a plateau with steep bluffs rising some 200 to 300 feet above the Hudson. Bemis Heights dominated the narrow defile of the river on its west side, and with the heavily wooded terrain surrounding the bluffs, it blocked the way to Albany. The dense forests were broken only by a few clearings and deep ravines formed by streams flowing into the Hudson. The greatest of these obstacles were Mill Creek and the Great Ravine to the north. South of Mill Creek and its southernmost tributary were the lines of the American entrenchments. And if you were a bird and you were looking down on the battle lines from above, it would resemble a three-sided square with the rear open. When completed, the works consisted of trenches and breastworks of logs and earth running for about 3/4 of a mile along each side of the open square. And then in the middle of each side, there was a position that was built up for artillery. At the northeast angle, Farmer Nelson's barn had been fortified and was dubbed by the soldiers in the area Fort Nelson. The overall defensive position had one drawback. Not far from its western side was a greater height, which, if occupied by the enemy, could command the American position. In the British camp, on September the 13th, finally resupplied and strengthened by the arrival of 300 regulars and a few more units of artillery, Burgoyne started crossing the Hudson River on a bridge of boats. The transfer was completed on the 14th, and the boat bridge dismantled by the 15th. By the 17th, they had marched southward and encamped around Swords Farm, which was north of Gates' position. And although Gates was only 4 miles away from Burgoyne, Burgoyne's intelligence was so poor that he was still unaware of Gates' position. And part of his lack of intelligence was due to the lack of Native American scouts, which, as we talked about a few moments ago, had left him after the Battle of Bennington. Burgoyne's first real knowledge of an American reconnaissance of his force came when an American patrol surprised a British foraging party in the act of digging potatoes on an abandoned farm. The patrol killed and wounded several British soldiers and camp followers and captured 20 prisoners. The incident jolted Burgoyne into pushing his limited intelligence means, and very soon thereafter, he became certain of Gates' positions and had some idea of his enemy's strength. What we see now is the stage is set, and our players are ready to play their play. The commanders are in position, and the battle is about to begin. And we'll continue our conversation on the Battle of Saratoga next week. Make sure to check out photos to help you understand the material presented here today at the website, www.AmericanMilitaryHistoryPodcast.com. If you think that today's episode was worth a dollar or two, why not head over to the website and donate to support the podcast? Visit AmericanMilitaryHistoryPodcast.com and click on the green button that says Support the Podcast. From there, you'll be able to give recurring donations with Patreon, or single or recurring donations with PayPal. The podcast is listener-supported, so every little bit helps, even if you're just buying me a cup of listener-supported coffee every month. Now, actually, one thing I would like to do with that, if you guys donate to support the podcast, If you guys know of any good, solid, veteran-run or veteran-owned and operated coffee companies, I'd actually like to switch to start buying my coffee from them, and then that would be the coffee that I would drink while I record the podcast. I feel like that would kind of help give back to the veteran community a little bit, you know, support the businesses that they've worked to start. So if you know of any that you want to suggest, reach out to me and let me know, either through social media or, that's actually the best way. Twitter or Facebook would be the best way. Speaking of my donors, I would like to thank my donors from this week. Cody M., who is one of my frequent retweeters, donates this week at the corporal level. Thanks, Cody. Thanks to all of my other donors for the support that you've given. It helps keep the podcast running. And thanks to all of you who have decided to do recurring donations. Thank you for honoring your donations this month. If you do decide to donate, you get your name mentioned on the website and also mentioned on future episodes. To stay up to date with the podcast, you can follow the podcast on Facebook and Twitter or with the email newsletter. Links to all of those are on the website, or you can search Facebook and Twitter for American Military History. We hit 200 followers this week on Twitter. That's great. Thanks to all of you that follow the Twitter account. I'm decently active on Twitter and Facebook, and you know, if you send me a message, I try and respond pretty quickly. Now, thanks to everyone who retweeted me on Twitter this week, at JimYat11, at Villain70, at HistoryCast, at D. Aaron Johnson, at McKeel88, at Ritterton, at ScubaPirate80, at 3PerSGT, at HistoryPodFan. If you would like the illustrious honor of having your Twitter name mentioned here, just retweet one of my tweets to your followers. It's that simple. This week saw two more 5-star reviews in iTunes from 82nd Pathfinders and from someone that looks like they just typed in a bunch of letters for their name. It's JFKTGG blah, 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 blah. So I'm not sure if that actually means something. If it does, sorry about that. But either way, thanks for leaving a review on the podcast. So thanks to everyone who's left a review on the podcast. That brings us up to 69 total ratings. That's awesome. Our goal is 75. And if we do math real quick, that tells us that we're only 6 away from our goal. Let's see if we can get 6 reviews today. Just run out there and do it. Again, as I've always said, if you can't financially support the podcast, doing a review on iTunes is really the best way that you can support the podcast. You don't really know how iTunes ranks podcasts. They don't really tell you, but you can kind of make some assumptions. Usually the higher your podcast is rated through reviews, you know, the better placement and positioning and stuff that you get in the iTunes store. So that can help bring us more listeners. And speaking of listeners and downloads and all that, we've hit another milestone. This week we hit 200,000 downloads. Now that's cumulative from the beginning of the podcast in July 4th of 2015. Now I talked about it on our last episode, and I made a comment that I didn't think we would hit 200,000 until the release of this episode. And once again, dear listeners, you proved me wrong, and we hit it only a day or two after releasing last week's episode. So maybe we'll hit 500,000 before the 1-year anniversary. That's about 5 months away. Means I've got to do about 100,000 a month. That's the wrong math. That means I have to do about 300,000 in 5 months. So I have to do about 60,000 a month. You guys can do it. Share the podcast with your friends, download, and let's see if we can hit it. One last thing to note about names. I've tried to be very, very conscious this week about pronouncing all the names correctly. I think I got it. If you guys, of course, well, I don't have to ask you. I know if you guys notice, you're going to tell me when I pronounce something wrong, but I think I got it this week. This good old Southern boy is learning how to say things right. But with that, I'll end this week's episode. And when we come back next week, shots are going to be fired at the Battle of Saratoga, Part 2. Take care.